Check. Okay.
This is the Barbershop Show, live from Carter's Barbershop, 3622 West Sumac, in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood, with your host, WBEZ's Richard Steele.
Well, this is the Barbershop Show. I'm Richard Steele. We're here at Carter's Barbershop in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood.
Yeah!
Hey. Well, in East Texas Hot Links,
yeah.
A play by Eugene Lee, seven strong-willed neighbors join forces to protect one of their own. The year is 1955, and times are changing in the Jim Crow South. But for all these changes, some things remain the same. East Texas Hot Links is running at the Writers Theater in Glencoe, Illinois, through January 22nd. Joining us in the shop right now, East Texas Hot Links director Ron O.J. Parson and Alfred Wilson, who plays Columbus Fry. How you doing?
Oh, good. Yeah.
Good to have you both here.
Great.
I went to see the show. And,
In a blizzard.
It was, man, it was. But it was certainly worth it.
Yeah.
It was a packed house, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, man.
And I'll tell you something really funny about that. When I was sitting there, I think I got the start time wrong. I think it was 6:15.
It was supposed to start at 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. Okay. Yeah. So when I'm there at like 5 to 6, they're just me and four other people.
Oh, wow.
So I'm saying, well, I guess it was the weather.
Yeah.
By 6:10. There was not a seat in the house.
That's right.
Wow.
You know,
that's every night.
Yeah, that's great.
Absolutely amazing. In East Texas Hot Links, black members of an East Texas community hang around the Top of the Hill Cafe. They laugh, they joke, they flirt, and they even argue. But what becomes clear is that outside of their oasis is a threat that has caused a number of young black men to disappear. So, Ron, you directed the Chicago premiere of this play over 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and Alfred, you were in the play 20 years ago.
He was in it and produced it. We had a theater company called Onyx Theater Ensemble, and that was our first show.
So this decision to bring it back, what goes into a decision about a play, especially in this situation where it's set in 1955, and from what I read, even the first time around, it was like, well, you know, 1955 was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this story now?
Right.
How relevant is it?
Right. Well, as I said before, James Byrd got dragged by a truck the week we opened in 1998, the second time we did it. So that
and for those who don't remember, it was a big news story, a racial incident where some white guys in a pickup truck dragged James Byrd.
A black man. down the road.
And he died.
Yes. And so I just thought that it was still relevant. And
the relevance comes in that the week that we started rehearsal was the day after the young man got killed in Oklahoma by the police.
This year.
Right.
Wow.
So we tried to, even in rehearsal, we you know, and Alfred was big on this, we got to look at it as it's happening now, you know. We everything that's relevant in the play was relating to what we're going through right now.
And race has become, it always has been an issue, but you know, given the political landscape this
exactly.
year,
it's, mm-hmm. yep.
the race is like, you know, at sort of
it
the
makes
forefront.
It more relevant. Yeah.
So, Alfred, you play Columbus, tell me a little bit about. First of all, tell me a little bit about for both of you, what the experience was like back then, and comparing it to what the experience is like now, just for you as actors and involved in this play.
Oh, when we did it the first time,
yeah.
you mean? Well, I mean, back then it was that we produced it, so everything that had to happen, we had to, you know, make that happen and get on stage and direct it. And,
yeah.
you know, so it's managing people and managing the building of the set. And,
okay.
and we really didn't have any money.
Product.
We didn't
yeah.
have much money. So.
Oh, no. Yeah, I was doing a lot of begging.
yeah.
And we got it done.
We
the difference
everything.
Now is that Writers Theater, you know, they put a lot of money into this production.
Right.
By the way, that's a beautiful theater.
It
really is.
Is.
I mean, it's obviously relatively new.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think
we're the second
show
in the small theater. There's two theaters in there. We're in the small one, but we're the second show in there.
It's like 99 seats?
Yeah, and that was one of the things Michael said to me. You know, I'm going to be, this new theater's happening. Let's do that East Texas that you did back 20 years ago. Let's do it in the new theater. And I said, yeah, okay.
I can do that, right? If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo. You can join the conversation by tweeting us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Right now we're talking about the play the East Texas Hot Links, playing in Glencoe through January 22nd at the Writers Theater. The question, this is a question I have for both of you. How is the response from a mostly white audience, like the one I saw when I went that night in Glencoe? I think there were three other black people, and I think they were related to somebody in the play. You know, how's that different from, or the same, as a response from a mostly black audience, since you know, race and racial discord is a significant part of the story, and as we just mentioned, race is still a major issue, and especially in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. You know, race is always at the top of the conversation mm-hmm. in a lot of instances. So talk about that for a little bit in terms of audience responses, because when you did it the first time,
it was 98% black.
Yeah, yeah, it was right, pretty exactly. multi. It, as we did it more, it got more mixed. But in the beginning, it was just like this small black theater company that was doing this play. And now Alfred probably can speak on that because he's there every night. I don't see the show like
so. Alfred, what's the story?
I'm surprised at the response that that we're getting from these audiences. And I mean, just last night, this guy was. And this has happened. This has been said almost every night. They say this is the best show they've ever done up here, and that they've been hungry for shows like this in Glencoe. If you're from Chicago and you know how that North Shore works, there's Evanston, Wilmette, Winnetka, Kenilworth, and Glencoe, and it almost seems like in 1955 in the Piney Woods, yeah. You have to drive through that gauntlet to get to Glencoe.
Sure,
and you're going to see 99% white. They've leapt to their feet.
Well, the night that I went, there was an extended standing ovation.
Yes,
because you came out afterwards to say some things to the audience about
Season of Concern.
Yeah, there's a collection that you right. guys take up for a charitable organization at the end. So after the play is over, you come up. But people were standing. But here's what's interesting about the standing ovation. Now, I heard Ron in an interview, I think on WGN Radio. And the lady who was interviewing you said, I guess whatever night she went, there was a question about people leaving the theater and they were kind of quiet and they didn't know how to respond. And I'm just wondering.
Well, I think that happens some nights because.
Right, there's a difference in terms of.
Not to despoil the ending, but it's people don't know how to react.
Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, the ending is really, it's a really.
Yeah.
It's a gut shot.
It is a gut shot.
It's a gut shot. Yeah. And what I would like to add, too, is that there is a difference in for the actors, I do believe, from a full black audience or white audience, because some of the elements of the humor, I think they don't understand, they don't realize these people are juking each other, and it's different. You know, it is different for them as actors, but it's nice when it's a mixture, a good mixture of people.
They miss a lot of the humorous back and forth. Some of the references, chitlins, you know. I mean, there's not going to be a lot of white people that know what chitlins are and the significance of that joke.
Good point.
Pig feet, trotter.
Good point.
You know, the pig feet and trotter.
In one scene, Roy, played by Kevin Roston Jr., flirts with
Kelvin.
Charles Allen. Yeah. Kelvin?
Kelvin.
Kelvin.
Yeah.
She's played by Tyler Abercrombie.
Tyler. They get funny about their names.
Tyler Abercrombie.
Yeah, right.
That light moment is shattered when XL, played by Nasir Smallwood.
Namir. Namir Smallwood.
Namir Smallwood. Okay, all right. Typos here.
Yeah.
Bursts their bubble with a cutting comment that hinted at Roy's unluckiness with love. Check this out.
Play C6 one time for me there, Roy.
What you gonna do for me?
I ain't studying you, Roy Moore.
I swear, woman, you treat me like a stepchild. Tomorrow ain't promised to you, nah. You gonna spend the rest of your life by yourself? You don't have to. Don't you want a man to take you places?
You mean like to the picture show in town on color night? I can go there by myself.
And for him, she held no torch of burning, no craving, no yearning. No place in our heart or in her loins. Tell me no, but don't tell me never. Just tell me that before you die, you might give me something.
All right, Roy. Before I die, I might give you something.
Thank you. That's why I'm going to get up tomorrow.
You probably like it better after you dead yourself. What you say? Boy, how you get to be as old as you are?
Hush, please, before somebody have to hurt you.
When y'all Harry asked me, that's all right, but if I do the same, it's not.
But we all just having fun.
You crossed the line.
I crossed the line. Y'all the ones treat me like I don't belong.
It's the squeaky wheel against the oil, XL.
Don't nobody mean you no harm, XL. We just don't understand you sometimes. But we don't think you understand you either. We know the good Lord ain't through with you yet.
But you can bet I done closed the book on you.
Boy, Ma, both y'all hush. Now, if you can't get along, little doggies, get along on out of here.
This is the Barbershop. I'm Richard Steele. A scene from East Texas Hot Links there. Let me see if I get the names right this time. Played by Kevin...
Kelvin
mm-hmm. Roston Jr.
Yep.
All right. Flirts with Charles Zetta, played by Tyler Abercrombie.
Okay. It's, yeah.
And that light moment is shattered when XL, played by Namir Smallwood,
there you go,
burst their bubble with a cutting comment that we heard just now. What's interesting about that slice of life, though, is, you know, while you just, as you mentioned before, we mm-hmm. took that break there, that, you know, some cultural things, people who are white from a different culture might understand. They can understand this part. This part could be in any juke joint or small restaurant. That's easy to understand, yeah. You know, guys talking stuff to a lady and all of that kind of stuff. So,
yep.
You know.
Yeah. That made me want to go back and see it. I ain't been in a while.
I noticed that that you blocked out the N-word. This is one of the interesting it ties to the question that you talked about before. What is it like doing this for a majority white audience? And that, you know, at one point they were talking about, you know, not using that word. And we're like, no. In 1955,
sure,
that was right. Just regular conversation. Right. We don't want to change anything in this play. And we don't want to dress it up just because the audience is white and they're going to get uncomfortable. We want them uncomfortable. We want them to understand what that was like. And we want them to understand what it's like right now. That word has not gone away, even though people are saying, you know, we shouldn't use that. Well, if that's what it is, I mean, that's it's being used every day.
By the way, it was not my decision to take the N-word out. Our producer's decision to do that. I personally would have left it in. But I understand the decision on that.
Yeah, I do too.
So, it's like August Wilson too. You know, yeah. The same thing that happens.
XL is a character that seemed to get on everybody's nerves at the diner, but there was something behind his attitude, too. So we're going to talk some more about the other parts of this play, what it means and you know, what it reflects as it relates to today's political and cultural situation as far as race is concerned. My name is Richard Steele. This is The Barbershop Show. After the break, more on East Texas Hot Links. We'll be right back.
Forever, my darling. My love will be true, always and forever. I'll love just you. Just promise me, darling, your love in return. Make this fire in my soul, dear, forever. My heart's at your command, dear, to keep love and to hold. Making you happy is my desire, dear. Keeping you is my goal. I'll forever love you the rest of my days. I'll never part from you and your loving.
We just heard Pledging My Love, Johnny Ace. You all wouldn't remember that.
I would.
I'm maybe a year older than you.
Okay. that's true, R&B legendary music.
Yeah.
You know, people back in the day, they used to say that the song was so powerful that one or two times somebody, like a woman, committed suicide listening to that song.
Wow. Mm.
Pledging My Love was a incredibly powerful song. Anyway, bringing you Shop Talk straight from Carter's Barbershop in the North Lawndale neighborhood. My name is Richard Steele. Join the conversation. Tweet us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Right now we're talking about East Texas Hot Links, a Eugene Lee play. The play runs through January 22nd at the Writers Theater. Joining us right now at the shop, two of the people from the production, the director, Ron O.J. Parson, and Alfred Wilson, who plays Columbus Fry. Alfred, what about Columbus Fry? This character seems to be generally a pretty good guy. In fact, we get to know a lot about the characters before the main conflict starts to unfold. We sort of get an inside look at some of the attitudes and feelings they have. But your guy seems to be not a bad guy.
No. Columbus represents that stable person in the community. And when you think of 1955, he owned property. He was a responsible person. He was a responsible adult. And he hung out at the bar. But that was what they had. You know, they didn't have, you know, barbershops.
No, that was everything. It was sort of the community listening post, right?
And so that's where you go and you meet. Columbus, like I said, being the most stable person around, he had owned property and people looked up to him and came to him for answers.
And he had a sister that was a bad cook.
And his wife. His wife was a bad cook.
The other guy's sister. Yeah.
Yeah. But he's older. You know, I like that. At the time that I did, when I did this before, I was 50.
No, you weren't that old.
No, I was 48.
Okay.
I'm considerably older.
Yeah. you're no numbers involved here. I hear you. All right, I got you.
I like how I use that considerably older.
Yeah.
But it now fits. It feels different. It feels better.
Sure.
Being this age and being this much older than the younger characters.
I think directing it too. I would say that we're older. We're all older. You know, Adolf, the guy playing Adolf, Willie Goodson. He was actually too young for the part when we did it before, but now he's that age.
Tell us about the playwright, Eugene Lee, who is from Texas, right?
Yeah. Eugene is from East Texas. He's a playwright, actor, director, educator, and just a phenomenal artist. He was here at the Goodman in Stop Reset, if anybody saw that, Regina's play, Regina Taylor.
Oh, that was amazing.
He played the lead guy. He was the older guy in that. And so he does a lot of writing and teaching. He's just a phenomenal guy. He's coming to the play in January. He's going to come see it, and we're going to have a little discussion after the show or before the show. I don't know exactly. But, he's just he was in Brewster's Place back with Old Roper way back.
Way back, yeah.
Yeah, and he was a member of the Negro Ensemble Company back in the day. So, yeah, he's been around, you know.
And leading the information in the playbook, between 1885 and 1942, 340 African Americans were lynched in Texas. Awful track. Texas was rough.
It was rough.
Where he was from. Mm-hmm. 1955 was, of course, when Rosa Parks decided to get on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama.
And Emmett Till.
So it's 55. Mm-hmm. 1955 was a very important time.
Exactly.
In the history of
the black movement. It was a pivotal time for us.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is explored in this play, the relationship between black folks and the relationship to white folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking around to see, kind of glancing around to see what the audience response would be when there was some dialogue about funny looking white people. I didn't notice that nobody flinched. You know,
that's what's been amazing about it.
Because that was inside talk.
Right.
So inside baseball talk among black folks.
In the locker room.
Yeah, in the locker room talk. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? So tell me a little bit about you've had some sessions afterwards to see what people are thinking after they see the play. Tell me about some of those.
I've only done a couple of those, but Alfred,
I haven't done any. I tend to babble when I start. When I get in discussions about this play, and you know, we have 20 minutes after the show to have talkbacks and discussions, I'll stand on the sideline and listen. Some of the questions and some of the statements, you know, tend to set me the wrong way.
Okay, yeah, I hear you.
So to avoid that, I will allow the younger people to address it.
And
if there's something that comes up that I need to step out, Ron knows me.
Yeah.
I'll sit back there and listen. And if something comes out wrong,
I'll
step up.
Right? And I think it's been very, the ones that I've witnessed, they have been pretty intelligent questions about the period and that is relevant today. And one white woman asked about what you just asked about, how is it, because she was from D.C. She said she grew up around a lot of black people, and she realizes that there was all these white people. How is it for the actors to work in that environment? And for one thing, I mean, I'm not speaking for all the actors, but, you know, they're up there doing a play, and they're in that world. So they find out maybe what the audience is after, but when they're in the play, they're in
the play,
you know?
Right,
yeah,
right, right.
And we hope to bring those people into that world, and that's what that theater setting is very good. We got Piney Woods, we got real trees, we got, you know, real bullets. You know, what I mean,
the set is
well,
really,
not real bullets,
and right?
Yeah. No, but I'm sorry, Richard, but the audience is they want to discuss this play.
Right.
The discussion night before last. After the show, a couple of them came up to me and they wanted to, you know, talk about it, because the post show discussion didn't bring up any of the questions about the play, and these people wanted to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and the person that was leading the discussion wouldn't let them go in that direction.
Okay, so they got you afterwards, right?
And then they came to me and they're like, okay, well, we need to see plays like this up here, okay. and this is what we wanted to talk about, but she didn't want us to talk about it, and you know, and so yeah, they it's. I'm pleasantly surprised about the response from audiences in Glencoe.
If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo. Right now we're talking about East Texas Hot Links at Writers Theater, as well as some of the real-life themes touched on in the Let me try that again. If you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show produced by Vocalo. Right now we're talking about East Texas Hot Links at Writers Theater, as well as some of the real-life themes touched on in the play. You can join the conversation with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Now, midway through the play, the cafe gets a particular jolt when Bucci, played by A.C. Smith, I've seen A.C. in a bunch of stuff. You know, he's sort of he's a real imposing figure.
Yeah, he
larger
is.
Larger than life.
He's larger than life, you know what I mean? I mean, not just because of his physical presence,
right.
But all that everything, his voice, his delivery, and his size.
Yeah.
He always, when he's on the set, it's kind of like, whoa, who's that guy?
Yeah, you that's why I picked him for that role, right. too, because the way he comes on.
Well, he gives young Delmas an ominous psychic reading, and here's some of that scene right now. Check this out.
How old are you, young brother?
23.
A young man. Let me see your hand.
Now, how much you gonna charge for the reading, Mr. Bucci? I ain't got but so much money on me this evening. Trying to save much as I can. Me and my new honey gonna get out these woods.
Where you going?
Houston. I want to be somebody. Make something of myself.
You and your honey?
I can't change the world from here. I gotta move.
I see. No charge for you this evening. Let me see your hand. Now, the other one. And you 23 now?
Yes, sir. What is it? What you see, Mr. Bucci?
You ain't no 23. You may not see 23. Somebody mean to do you harm. It's hanging over your head, a dark cloud.
I don't see no cloud over his head. Where that, Bucci? Look like he got a pretty bright future to me.
I'm just telling you what I see. What you do about it is your business. I didn't know nothing about who you was going to work for. But that just proves my point. I know he your boss, XL, but they ain't. You know I loves me some money, but they ain't made enough to pay me to work for that son of a.
Mr. Even be about to get you directly.
XL, you call that white man back and tell him Delmas ain't working for him.
They on their way now. Be hell and pay to come out here for nothing.
What kind of work was it they say they had for you to do?
Good question.
Note said $65 a week. Here, see for yourself.
XL. Didn't you just say a while ago that but no work happened on that highway this week?
I said half crew.
I imagine he hard-pressed to find anybody to work for him these days.
$65 a week?
Found this note in my box this morning. Mr. Bucci, could you look again? Maybe you missed something. I mean, if I'm gonna get this job, I need to make myself some money.
I don't need to look again.
And that's from East Texas Hot Links. That's the play in Glencoe at the Writers Theater. That scene was Bucci, played by A.C. Smith, talking to Delmas, a young man. He's getting a psychic reading from Bucci.
Mm-hmm.
Bucci's kind of a player.
Yeah, he's a
down south player.
Yeah, gambler player.
Yeah, gambler
right.
player.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting scene, and it's interesting with this play. By the way, this is the Barbershop Show. I'm Richard Steele, but it's interesting how. All of these things, these side issues, lead up to the conclusion,
mm-hmm.
and it really is written well, and draws you in.
Well, Eugene was into some of the similar type of things I was into, Rod Serling and Twilight Zone.
Okay.
So when Bucci comes on the scene, it has an ominous feel about it. You don't know what it is, just what he says. Something don't feel right.
Wasn't this written initially like a Twilight Zone?
I don't think it was. No, I think just that Eugene was just influenced
like
by
that.
Yeah, because we talk about some episodes, but yeah, he just has that feel to it.
A.C. Smith as Bucci, a loose is it loose Matreus?
Loose, yeah.
Loose Matreus as Delmas, and Namir Smallwood as XL in the Writers Theater production of East Texas Hot Links. After that scene, the play begins to take a chilling direction. Notably, the day that you started, you talked about this before, the day you started rehearsals at the Writers Theater was the day after the police shooting in Charlotte of Keith Lamont Scott.
Right.
The second day of rehearsals, they released a video of the Tulsa police shooting of Terrence Crutcher. So what kind of impact did that have, do you think, on the plays, on the people involved with the play?
I think it became important. It was a discussion for me every day that we kept close to what's happening, and that we keep that in mind while we're doing this play. That in 1955, about Bird, and that right now the same things are happening, the same themes are going through this play, and it's important that we bring that to the people of Glencoe. And again, they've been very accepting of the story.
The McDonald's shooting too. Once we got to going in rehearsal and different things were happening, we were like, man, that could be. And it gave me some ideas even while we were doing the play as far as that ending. You know, I mean, the whole 16 shots and things like
that.
Did
you tell them about the 16 shots?
No, I didn't.
Did you want to or no?
Yeah, well, we could.
It's important. I mean, it's...
But
go ahead.
Well, we just felt, I mean, you know the ending, but again, not spoiling too much of it, but we...
Laquan McDonald here in Chicago.
Right.
We wanted
shot
to
by
have,
a police officer 16 times.
Right, and so some nights it's full out, that ending, and sometimes we wanted those 16 shots to be heard. So if you notice, some of the bullets in that shooting is... very loud.
Yeah, I mean, it jars you out of your chair.
16 of them.
16 of them. And that was our idea, you know. And I told the actors, I said, everybody won't get it. Everybody won't feel it.
Nope.
But we feel it.
But we know it.
And that's what's happening.
Sure.
It's a different internalizing for the actors.
Well, I hope at some point, we had a brief discussion. We're wrapping up here, but it would be great to have that play produced here in Chicago.
Yeah, it really would.
I mean, the audiences are obviously sell out, because when I mean to go on a night like I went, the weather was so bad,
and
it was
so
sold
full.
Out, you know, unbelievable. So I'm sure it would be a
That's
huge
great.
Hit
well,
here in Chicago.
And even if it can't come back down to Chicago, that
come out and see
that
it,
audiences come. I mean, that we could get our Chicago audiences to come to Glencoe to see this play, and they would be excited to see how it's set up.
Yeah.
And when I talk about driving through Kenilworth, Wilmette, Winnetka, and then finally getting to the top of the hill, it is like driving through the piney woods of East Texas.
And by the way, I should also point out, though, as Glenn, Ron pointed out to me, you can take Metro and get there like
very easily.
Yeah. So
DeSabo has a thing. We had a deal where they can call DeSabo and get a discount if they're members of DeSabo, and we're trying to work out a shuttle service and trying to get people up there, but that's the only thing working right now with DeSabo.
Okay, well, it's going to be shown through the 22nd of January, and East Texas Hot Links at the Writers Theater in Glencoe. An amazing production with some incredible actors. By the way, just as an aside, you had some other projects.
Yeah, well, a project beyond the stage, trying to get young people involved in technical theater, young people of color. So we just raised the money and we reached our goal, so that's going to be happening. And I have another show, we're in rehearsal at Blues for an Alabama Sky at Court, but look for Blues for an Alabama Sky, Pearl Klig in January.
By the way, I saw you in an episode of Chicago PD.
Oh, man.
I think something happened. You had lost your son who was killed.
My grandson was
killed.
It was kind of crazy, but it was fun.
Ron, O.J. Parsons.
I do a little acting, too.
Acting, too.
Right?
You know what I mean? All right, well, thanks a lot, guys. It was a real pleasure to have you here and have this discussion. And we'll check it out, East Texas Hot Links. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks.
Stay tuned to the Barbershop Show, produced by Vocalo, coming up after the break. We'll revisit a story of learning to heal through the art of Latin drumming. Plus, we'll hear about an artist learning to push forward towards her dreams. We'll be right back.
para Chano, aunque la gloria le está. Después de haberlo perdido, lo tenemos que mentar. Mientras suenan los tambores, nadie te podrá olvidar. A ti.
And you just heard Chano Pozo by Mongo Santa Maria. I'm Richard Steele. This is the Barbershop Show, brought to you straight from Carter's Barbershop in North Lawndale. Join the conversation by tweeting us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Well, a few times a year, Vocalo conducts our storytelling workshop. It's an opportunity for community members to get free training in audio production, citizen journalism, and narrative storytelling. On today's show, we'll meet two of the latest graduates of the six-week storytelling workshop. And we'll also hear some of their final projects. So right now, we're joined by Gloria Guadarrama. Gloria Guadarrama.
Perfect.
Did I get it right?
You got it. Perfect.
Okay, and Brittany Leanne Williams.
Yes.
Good to have both of you here. We're also joined by Ayanna Contreras, who's here every Friday. She's the person who is producing this show, and she's also the one who facilitates the storytelling workshop. So a little bit, Ayanna, about the workshop. I happened to walk in on it by accident one Saturday. I was at the radio station. So you work, you're like every day you work, right?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if everybody is old enough to remember Living Color, and they had that skit Hey Mon, where they had
like 19 jobs. These people are old enough to remember.
That's me.
All of these people, right? Okay, all right.
Yeah, so.
You have a lot of jobs.
Yep, I have a lot of jobs. We're not even going to get into that right now. But yeah, what we do with the storytelling workshop, and it's really near and dear to the mission of Vocalo, is we take regular folks, community members who apply, in a six-week intensive workshop, which teaches them, they don't have to have any experience in radio, in journalism, in anything. And by the end of the 6 weeks, hopefully they'll have a piece that's airable.
Okay, so Gloria and Brittany, this is the first time that you've done anything like this, right? Producing work for audio, and the radio stuff, and it's like brand new stuff. What encouraged you to do this? I mean, what made you, did you hear somebody who did that, or did somebody tell you, hey, this is a good thing to do, or what? Or was it just listening to this show? No, just go this listening to Vocalo. No. Tell your own story. How'd you get started?
Yeah, so I think I've always loved just podcasting. I like listen to a lot of podcasts, and I have a deep appreciation for storytelling. And so I wanted to try it as a medium that I could like just like test and see if I could do it. And when I found out that this was an opportunity, I applied and got really excited about doing a project.
So Brittany, do you have a podcast that you do?
No, I don't. Okay. So I like, this is so brand new. I am like completely an amateur at storytelling in this way. I'm actually an artist. So I just wanted to see a different medium of expressing myself.
Okay. What about you, Gloria?
I love Vocalo. Honestly, I do. And I love Ayanna.
We paid her, didn't we? Did we say that? No. Okay, no. Seriously.
And you, Uncle Ricardo Steele.
Yeah. I'll be that. I'm good for that. Okay.
When I was a teen, the Mexican Museum owned a radio station that showed teens about radio, but I never got a chance to actually produce anything. So when I saw this opportunity, I'm like, I'm 34. That's the cutoff age. I signed up immediately. And thank goodness I was accepted. It was a beautiful experience.
Well, before we go any further, we've got some excerpts from Brittany's piece from the workshop. Let's check that out. Listen to this.
The story you are about to hear is brought to you by the Chicago Community Trust, our region's community foundation. Check out hashtag Trust100 on social media or visit www.cct.org to join them in inspiring Chicagoland to become the most generous and philanthropic region in the nation.
This is Brittany Leanne Williams for Vocalo.
I remember a client told me one time, because I always used to be like the, you know, I'm black, I'm young, I'm a woman, I gotta work real hard.
I feel that.
Gotta run.
Seriously. As a young black female artist, I'm magnetically drawn to what Janice is saying. I've had that feeling, that running feeling, still have that feeling. That pressure to run about like a chicken with your head cut off, just because you know you're the only black chick in the room. But in this moment, Janice and I are doing the antithesis of running. We're sitting in Woman Made Gallery in Wicker Park, surrounded by black female artwork that Janice herself has curated and organized. But though we're chilling and vibing, there's still this sense that I need to keep running, because it's real.
Look, it's real. It's real to a point.
Okay.
One of the smartest things that a client told me once, I was helping them with a really big production.
Okay.
I was just like nervous. I was like, oh God, this person. So I'm running to do something. And she stops me. She was like, don't run. She was like, you can move quickly, but don't run. Mm. Because if you run and something happens to you, then everything else is going to fall apart. Mm.
Janice Bond is an amazing artist and curator that met me in a studio visit months back. My work is in her curated show, Abandoned Martians, The Policing of the Female Black Body. And I'm truly captivated by how Janice owns her accomplishments. But who taught this chick to be so bad? How did she know how to score at being a businesswoman? We fall into an abrupt story time where she samples stories of how young Janice Bond from Texas becomes the curator and artist I now know. She brings up her days of waitressing and serving rich bougie folks. I almost stopped cold when she casually spouted how she served P. Diddy Combs and his massive entourage.
He comes and it's like, I remember he had these crazy diamonds. That was the first time I had seen diamonds that big up close. These tennis bracelets look like bangles from African Fest, but they were just full of diamonds.
Janice takes his order, makes the drink, serves it.
So it was nothing to me to ask, you know. I was just standing there, and he looks up at me, and I was like, so are you going to pay for your drink?
Who asked P. Diddy to pay for his cheap drink? The crew sneered, but Janice was keeping it real. All business. Even if you're Puff Daddy, my girl's not playing. Whether she's serving cocktails or curating a space, Janice is a force to be reckoned with. As we wrap up, she poetically tells me about her future plans.
In the future, creating more space, creating more work.
Awesome.
Creating more channels and building wealth for my daughters. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a modest art collection. A lot of Chicago artists are in it. Some are from different places. Cool. But that's part of my legacy. Also, yes. To my children, continuing to collect art.
Awesome.
Joining groups like Diaspora Rhythms. Also being on the board at the Art Institute. Also being on the board at Southside Community Art Center. And staying heavily involved with those institutions from the north side to the south side.
Good.
And really living a life, even with its complexities, that shares and shows that it's just really possible to do it, I guess, on your own terms.
That piece was produced by Brittany Leanne Williams for the Vocalo Storytelling Workshop. You can hear more of the piece and many others at vocalo.org/storytellers. That's what you have to go to hear it. All right, vocalo.org/storytellers. Okay. All right, if you're just joining us, this is the Barbershop Show, produced by Vocalo.org. You can join the conversation. Tweet us with the hashtag Barbershop Show. Right now we're talking about the new work from participants of the Vocalo Storytelling Workshop. How did it feel to hear your piece, knowing it's on the radio?
A little awkward.
As well as being on the
radio. I know, yeah.
Sitting here listening to yourself, right?
Definitely awkward. Like, everyone doesn't love their voice, or at least I don't. So it's interesting.
Trust me, nobody loves their voice when they first hear it on the radio.
Yes.
That's very true.
It just sounds high. I swear my voice sounds high. But yeah, it was really good to hear it. I mean, my project, I think, was very selfish in the fact that I wanted to probe at these artists that are in my community and see their thoughts and wisdom. So, yeah, hearing it, it's what I wanted. Like, I got what I wanted, and I hope the listeners like it as much as what I wanted.
You're charged up now. You want to do more of that, right?
I do. I think I have learned it's incredibly, like, difficult. It's a lot of work that goes into this medium of work. And so in the future, I think I have a realistic perspective of how to build this and make it come together. But I will in the future. I don't know how often. It's just a lot of work.
You know, because people probably don't know, I mean, they don't even think about the fact that the entire piece, and we just heard a portion of it, is about, the entire piece is like 9 minutes long. But
yes.
To get 9 minutes of really good audio,
yes.
And good story, it's not easy.
No, it's
pretty
not.
Pretty difficult.
And editing, and oh my gosh, it's a lot. Yeah.
Today we're talking with two of the latest graduates of the 6-week Vocalo Storytelling Workshop, and we're here with their final projects. You just heard earlier in this hour from Brittany Leanne Williams and her project. Now we have Gloria Guadarrama and her project. How you doing?
How's it going?
So tell me a little bit about what your project is. We're going to play this in a second, though, but how you got involved with this. I mean, we said a little bit about that, but you really were interested in doing this as something that was a pursuit for you. You said, I'm going to do this, right?
Well, I mean, I was the one that used to think about philanthropy as being just about, you know, like Carnegie, Gates, and it's way more than that, you know. And I thought of a person that really helped me out a lot in my life that didn't know that, so I decided to do that on my first drum teacher.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Because unlike Carnegie and those, you didn't make your million yet, so after you do that, then you'll do the other part, right? All right, Gloria, your piece is about someone you admire. Let's check it out. This is an excerpt from Gloria's piece for the Vocalo Storytelling Workshop. Check it out.
The story you are about to hear is brought to you by the Chicago Community Trust, our region's community foundation. Check out #Trust100 on social media or visit www.cct.org to join them in inspiring Chicagoland to become the most generous and philanthropic region in the nation.
I am one out of the 40 million Americans that deals with the paralyzing symptoms of anxiety and depression. My personal choice, after having tried meds in the past, was to try to find any other option to help me heal from past traumas. I found that healing through music. I discovered Latin percussion through the eyes of someone who offered a totally new perspective of what it really meant. The main reason I chose to focus my piece on Carlos Cornier was because he displays what philanthropy is all about. In the past, I would tend to associate the word philanthropy with only the wealthy, like Bill Gates, Andrew Carnegie, and Warren Buffett. But I learned that a philanthropist is also a person who donates their time and shares their knowledge with others. Those who are genuine and giving, with strong desires to teach and motivate, are just as important and also deserve to carry that powerful title, philanthropist. I was curious to know how he ended up becoming a drummer.
I was a hippie, and it was hard to believe. I was, you know, look at me with my tattoos and my earrings and all that. Yes, I used to be a hippie. And I was at Woodstock in 69. And when I came back, I missed a lot what was going on there. In other words, I didn't see many of the acts, but when I finally saw the movie and saw what I missed when I was at the festival, there was a band called Santana. That turned my life around. I rejected my parents' music, Tito Puente and all that. To me, that was kind of corny. I was into Led Zeppelin. In fact, I was always at the Fillmore East seeing Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Stones. I got to see Madison Square Garden. So that was it. You had a rockero, you know, that was my thing. But then seeing this movie, and after coming back from Woodstock and seeing Santana, seeing them adding this drum that I was familiar with into my world, into the so-called rock world, I went and got my first conga. And I taught myself that first rhythm I saw on that movie, Soul Sacrifice.
Just keep that going.
So I bought myself two congas. But then something happened. I started going backwards and checking out, okay, who is Tito Puente? And who is Mongo Santa Maria? And I started checking all these cats. So I started going reversing, you know, to see what was there before Santana. By coincidence, this was happening at the same time as people of color were what we used to call conscious raising, right? So you had the Black Panther Party, you had the Young Lords and Latinos, you had the White Panthers, you had the Native Americans organizing. So all this was happening at the same time in the early 70s. So you were kind of, I know it's a long-winded answer, but it was all happening at the same time. I discovered the drum as I was discovering my people.
Carlos Cornier was my first drum teacher, and since day one, I started to feel at ease in his class. I came in with a lot of anxiety and doubts about my ability to be able to learn anything at age 25. When I was a kid, I thought music classes were only for the privileged, and I also thought that since I was not exposed to music classes at an early age, I couldn't possibly master any instrument, thus seeing it pointless to even try to learn something that I would never be able to perfect. But I felt encouraged by him sharing with me his beginnings and how drumming changed his life.
You know, I always felt I wasn't too good at anything in my world. You know, as growing up, I kind of faked a lot of stuff, working 9 to 5. You know, you do things, you know, and I never really felt I was good at anything. I mean, I have to admit, I came to Chicago, actually, to go to film school, Columbia College, and I was okay. I won several awards for a documentary I did, and then I followed that up with a bigger documentary that got me in trouble. I won't go into details about that. But I remember getting laid off from my third job in the early 90s, and I was an angry 40-year-old. That was my third job, and I just bought a house, and I have two kids at that time, two young kids. And I said, okay, that's it. I'm not working for anybody anymore. I'm not working for anybody 9 to 5. What could I do with my hands? And I was okay conga player. I wasn't that great, but I could keep time. And I remember how to play the tumbao, which is a classic Cuban pattern. And I got a gig. I joined Primal Connection. I started doing corporate gigs. I started teaching at Old Town. And I was always surprised. Me? Teach? What do I know? But I kept on expanding. I did know more than I thought. So I realized I was good in this. And not only that, I enjoyed showing people how to play. I also enjoyed history. So that opened up a whole thing for me to talk about the history of our people of the Caribbean. I always like to start off by telling people, I introduce myself with my name. I have a Spanish first name and a French last name, which is typical of the Caribbean. So that's how I begin my classes.
And this is the Barbershop Show. I'm Richard Steele. That piece was produced by Gloria Guadarrama. Gloria Guadarrama is one of our guests today for the Vocalo Storytelling Workshop. You can hear more of that piece and many others at vocalo.org/storytellers. Well, how about a little live drumming right here in the barbershop? Check it out. Live at the barbershop, Richard Steele here. And you just heard Carlos Cognier along with Gloria Guadarrama. Carlos is the teacher, and it's great to have you here, Carlos. Good to see you again after many, many years. Now, how'd you get this story, Gloria? How'd you hook up with Carlos?
I signed up for his class when I was 25. And, I mean, it just changed my life. When I was a kid, I didn't see a point to sign up if I wasn't going to be like a pro at it, you know, or make a living out of it. But I just, you know, it's just something that I always wanted to do, and I had to face my fear and just sign up, you know. And it just, I can't even explain the ways it's just changed my life. Yeah.
As you point out, you never thought you'd be a teacher.
No, in fact, I'm embarrassed to say that I was a terrible student in school when I was young, and I never felt good. I never felt I was really good or particularly in anything. But when I discovered the drum, oh my God, did I fall right into it! And one of the greatest pleasures I have is seeing. I love what we expression we use, newbies. I love seeing the expression of people when they discover the drum, and then on top of that, telling folks about the history of that drum, the history of that drum coming from Africa to between your legs, what transpired in between. I love history, and I love our history, and I say our history because being Boricua, Puerto Ricano, Puerto Rican, means that, you know, we are an indigenous people, a European people, an African people, and I love that combination. It drives me nuts. I love the history of that. So I love telling that in between learning the rhythm. So it's not just about playing music, but it's also understanding the history of our people.
And you pass that on to some willing students, right? Yeah. You've been listening to The Barbershop Show, bringing you Shop Talk from Carter's Barbershop, located at 3622 West Cermak in Chicago's North Lawndale neighborhood. If you have any comments on today's show, give us a call at 888-635-1112. Press 2 to leave a message. I want to thank our guests today. Thanks to Ron O.J. Parson and Alfred Wilson. Thank you, guys. Brittany Leanne Williams and Gloria Guadarrama. Our show today was produced by executive producer Ayanna Contreras. Our managing director is Sylvia Rivera. Colin Ashmead Bobbitt was our remote engineer. Our intern is Emma Farley. The Barbershop Show has a podcast. You can find it in the WBEZ iTunes store and download it for free. So for everybody here at Carter's Barbershop, my name is Richard Steele. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah. You.